Well, Mr. Boot, I was passing through Albuquerque. Had breakfast here. Read your paper. Thought you might be interested in my reaction.
You bet I am.
Well, sir, it made me throw up. I don't want you to think I expected the New York Times. But even for Albuquerque, this is pretty Albuquerque.
All right. Here's your nickel back. Now, what's all this about my making $200 a week?
Apparently, you're not familiar with my name.
Can't say that I am.
That's because you don't get the Eastern papers out here. I thought maybe once in a while somebody would toss one out of the super chief and you might have seen my byline. Charles Tatum? Worked in New York, Chicago, Detroit.
What about the 200?
I was coming to that. Mr. Boot, I'm a $250 a week newspaper man. I can be had for 50.
Why are you so good to me?
I know newspapers backward, forward, and sideways. I can write them, edit them, print them, wrap them, and sell them.
Don't need anybody right now.
I can handle big news and little news. And if there's no news, I'll go out and bite a dog. Make it 45.
What makes you so cheap?
A fair question, considering I've been top man wherever I've worked. You'll be glad to know that I've been fired from 11 papers with a total circulation of 7 million. For reasons with which I don't want to bore you.
Go ahead, bore me.
I'm a pretty good liar. I've done a lot of lying in my time. I've lied to men who wear belts. I've lied to men who wear suspenders. But I'd never be so stupid as to lie to a man who wears both belt and suspenders.
How's that again?
You strike me as a cautious man. A man who checks and double checks. So I'll tell you why I was fired. In New York, a story of mine brought on a libel suit. In Chicago, I started something with a publisher's wife. In Detroit, I was caught drinking out of season. In Cleveland,
I get the picture.
Now then, I find myself in Albuquerque with no money. A burnt-out bearing, bad tires, and a lousy reputation.
Bad tires can be dangerous.
I've only one chance to get back where I belong. To land a job on a small-town paper like yours and wait and hope and pray for something big to break. Something I can latch on to.
You are listening to They Must Be Destroyed on Sight. The following podcast contains adult language, adult situations, and spoilers for the movies discussed occur often. You've been warned. Now, take it away, Dr. Rausch.
They must be destroyed on sight.
Hello and welcome to They Must Be Destroyed on Sight, episode 306. It's been like a month since we've had a regular episode of the show. So, yeah, we're back. And I'm your host, Lee, Human Interest Russell. And I am joined by my original favorite co-host. Don't tell Lady Lee that. Daniel, for Albuquerque. This is pretty Albuquerque, Harper. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, and I will not tell Lady Lee, and she probably won't listen to this episode, so it's going to be fine.
She might. I'm kind of hoping she will, just so she'll, like, what the fuck did you just say? And then...
Yeah, I know, and then she will beat you to within an inch of your life for her not being the favorite, because she's the new hot blood. I'm the old fashioned. I'm the old guy, you know, like, you know, I'm the OG, but like, I haven't been around for a while. So, you know, like you're the spurned spouse in this situation, ultimately, you know?
Yeah. You know, honestly, I just like playing people against each other. I want to see fights. I want to see arguments, you know?
Also, I have actually been to Albuquerque, like, on the Amtrak route, the Southwest Chief goes through, which was the Super Chief before the invention of Amtrak. And they reference the Super Chief even in the references. Somebody throws a paper out of the Super Chief.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, it is like that was a hugely trafficked route back in the before the advent of the U.S. highway system, the interstate system. So cool. Anyway, I have traveled on that exact stretch of rail. Although, you know, I did it in 2021 instead of 1951, and it's a different experience, but, you know,
which is
70 years ago at this point.
Yeah. Right, right, yeah.
Can't believe how old this movie is.
People might ask us, well, why don't you do like a recent movie that people might have actually seen? And it's like, well, why would you do that? Why cater to an audience? Why cater to people who might actually like think that certain films are relevant to discuss? No, no, no. We're talking about something that's 73 years old.
Yeah, Ace in the Hole from 1951. We'd rather watch movies that thousands of people who are now dead have seen. That's yeah. Much more our
thing. It's much better to watch a movie that literally no person making it is still alive.
Yeah,
that way, you know, you know, like
yeah. I don't know. I don't know if anyone involved with this is still alive at this point.
I mean, from 73 years ago. Yeah, no, I think it's pretty likely that literally no single human being. I mean, Kirk Douglas died in 2020, and he was 103 at the
103,
time.
103, yeah,
so, yeah. So like, there's. I think there's no question that like literally everybody who worked on this film is dead at this point.
You know? Although I will say, I was looking through the cast, and this is a stark change from like when we were like doing movies from like the 20s and 30s, where everyone died at like 45 of like, you know, cirrhosis of the liver or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of these people had very long productive lives.
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, it's a prestige picture. From 1951, like, you know, despite everything, like this was a big budget movie, you know. Mm-hmm. So no reason to suspect that people would not live a long time, or at least have a long career, you know.
So we're gonna get into that, but before we do that, we'll talk about what we watched in the last little while. So I'll throw over to you first, Daniel, because this is something we both share that we've watched recently. So I'll let you start in.
So I did watch Oppenheimer. I have not seen Barbie. I did not do the full Barbenheimer experience, but I did watch. I do want to watch Barbie. If nothing else, I love Margot Robbie. I think she's great. And like, I think like it'd be a fun watch at some point. I did watch Oppenheimer. Jack and I did it. My co-host on my other podcast, we did it on our Patreon bonus. Go subscribe to my Patreon for $1 a month. Then you can get to listen to the full conversation. It's bad. Oppenheimer's bad. It's funny that like I got somebody who had apparently just didn't know what he was getting into, who subscribed to my Patreon, and after we put that episode up, he like did a wallow text of, you know, like, you guys just hate movie, you hate everything good, and I'm like look at his thing, and it's like has been subscribed for 17 days, and so that person probably paid me a total of $1. And you know what, dude, I will refund your dollar. You know, I'm sorry. You obviously did not know what you were getting into. Oppenheimer, like, it's well made. Of course it's well made. Like, there's no question. It is like, it looks great.
Yeah.
It is well acted for what it, like, Nolan, like, I think Nolan has moved backwards in terms of his like ability to like understand actors.
He's bad at casting people. Like,
well, I don't even think it's casting. Like, I just like, you look at that movie and Matt Damon is in a whole other movie. Like, he's doing the buddy comedy version of like, in which he and Robert Oppenheimer are like buddies just trying to like get along in this like weird military system. That sounds like a fun movie, and it is a fun movie, but it's like 25 minutes in this like 3-hour overbloated epic.
They're doing the men who stare at goats or whatever the fuck, you know, like,
right.
Yeah.
And Robert Downey Jr. just gets to chew scenery for, you know, the entire time that he's on, particularly in the latter like third of the movie, like in the last, particularly in the last like 20 minutes, it's just Robert Downey Jr. just chewing scenery.
They gave him an Oscar for the category of, oh, we should have gave you an Oscar 20 years ago.
Absolutely. It's like, yeah, you get addicted to heroin, and then you play Tony Stark, and now you're in a prestige movie again, so we should probably give you an Oscar. And like, it's just bad. I don't know. Like, it's just bad. There's so much more I could say, but I've already said it. Go subscribe to my Patreon for $1 a month and listen. Like, it's fine.
And I watched it. I watched it before I listened to your guys' review, and I was like, pretty much everything I thought about it, and then just a lot of things I didn't realize I kind of thought about it, but it's like, oh yeah, no, yeah, that's true. yeah, no, this movie is really fucking awful, and it's like, it's one of those cliche, like, here's 3 hours I can't get back. Like,
yeah.
Nolan doesn't know how to give you a sense of time and space in any given shot that he makes. Like, it's, yeah. he makes pretty looking films. He makes like really good kinetic energy that you can't really necessarily follow the action, but it's flashy and it looks good. The atomic bomb blast. Hey, it looks really great.
Oh yeah. No, there's a good like 15 minutes of this, which is riveting. You know, the actual atomic bomb test, clearly some effort went into that. Like, that is a brilliant sequence. I would put that in like some of the best filmmaking I've seen in my life. That sequence, bar none, perfect. The movie that's wrapped around, total horseshit on many
yeah.
levels.
Yeah, kudos to Jack for pointing out that like this movie misquotes Albert Einstein at one point and just makes him like this feeble old guy who's past his time and is like stupid about math. Like, what are you talking about? Like,
right,
none of that makes any sense. Like,
no it doesn't. Like, it is just like, I mean, yeah, no, it's and the fact that like Richard Feynman is portrayed in the movie, and you literally have to like know that that's Richard Feynman. Like, mm-hmm. the only thing you get on that is like he's occasionally carrying bongos. And so, like, even to someone who is, like, well aware of the history, like, I only realized it was Feynman, like, when I said, oh, he's carrying bongos. And so suddenly, like, okay, that's supposed to be Feynman, I suppose. And I like Jack Quaid. I think Jack Quaid is a really, like, perfectly fine, I don't want to say young actor. He's probably not that much younger than me. But, yeah. You know, he's in his 30s, like, but he's a, you know, he's very good in The Boys. He's, you know, he's a perfectly fine actor. No questions asked. And he's just given nothing to do. He's given nothing to do, like, you know. And, yeah. and that kind of like everybody in the movie is given nothing to do. I liked Florence Pugh. Florence Pugh can do no wrong.
What a fucking thankless role though for her.
Absolutely
disgusting. Like, she was portraying a real person who had a lot of, like, you know, she had a life, she had complex, and in this movie it's like, oh, Oppenheimer's done fucking her, so goodbye. Like,
the only thing, sorry, the spoiler alert for Oppenheimer, the only thing that keeps her alive is access to Oppenheimer's dick,
yeah,
in this movie. And then once she can't have that anymore, well, you might as well drown yourself in a bathtub. Like, that's the, and you know, like, I understand good dick, like, good dick is a thing, but you know, somehow I don't think that like that particular woman was so hurting for dick that, you know, she needed Robert Oppenheimer.
Yeah, I don't you know, like
he's probably not that good is what I'm saying, you know. Like,
I just, you know, as much as I don't want to like just break this down into some like politically charged like liberal take on this, it's just like I'm looking at this privileged white guy who lost a little bit of power after helping develop the atomic bomb, and now he's sad about it because it might have killed thousands of people.
He incinerated like hundreds of thousands of people. Like,
yeah,
you know, his work led directly to the incineration of hundreds of thousands of people. And we're supposed to feel bad for him. And you know what? I said this in the podcast, you know, like, which you can listen to if you, again, pay me $1 a month. Yeah, you can see that. I think there is a legitimate conversation around the scientists who, like, worked on the atomic bomb, who fled Nazi Germany, who were Jewish, and went like, well, the Nazis are annihilating, like, are literally committing genocide. And, you know, they're a warmongering, like, nation that's going, that has to be stopped. And so what does it take? So working on this bomb, working on this new weapon might end that war, might end that conflict, might end that, you know, might end the genocide. Yeah. And I think there is a legitimate, like, point of view of, you know, maybe this actually is the best thing for me to do.
Right.
I think that's a difficult question. And I think that feeds into like people who work in the arms industry now, like, you know, people who work in, you know, people who work for Raytheon, they get a bunch of people, you know, kind of out of college who, you know, go into aerospace engineering, go into mechanical engineering, go into electrical engineering. You're not making a bomb. You're working on a circuit board.
Right.
That's going to do have this kind of, you know, schematic. We give you an endpoint and an outpoint. You're doing this thing. And it has non-military applications and it has military applications.
Yeah.
And you're not working on the, like, military side. And, you know, like, it's a good job. You're just out of college. You're doing the thing. You make decent money. You're not making millions of dollars, but, you know, like, it's a job. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to compartmentalize that. And
yep.
Oppenheimer, the film, has – it gestures at that, like, very vaguely for, like, 30 seconds out of the movie.
Yeah.
But it has no interest in, like, actually engaging with that conversation, which it's just a big swing and a miss. Like, you know, again, it's well made in the sense of it looks great. It's well acted, although, again, like, everybody's acting in their own different movie, like, you know, like, you know, but it's bad. It's just, it's bad.
It was perfect. Terrible Oscar bait is what it is.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have one thing I'll mention. Sure. The Beach Bum from 2019.
Okay.
This is directed by Harmony Korine. Of course, you know, wrote Kids, directed Gummo, has done a bunch of, like, sort of like transgressive kind of shit in his career.
Didn't he do that Spring Breakers Selena Gomez movie? Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So this is Matthew McConaughey basically doing the most Matthew McConaughey performance. Have you seen this?
I have not.
No.
I'm just sitting here laughing at, like, I imagine what Harmony Korine would do with Matthew McConaughey in a movie called The Beach Bum. Like, I'm fascinated. I'm definitely gonna watch this. Like, go ahead, Lee. Tell me.
This movie took me places that I did not expect it to take me. Like, it's somewhat a comedy, and at the same time, it's somewhat like docudrama in the way it's kind of filmed. But, like, Matthew McConaughey's just this, like, poet who maybe, like, was renowned at one point, but he's got a rich wife in Isla Fisher, who is just, like, smoking hot in this film. But he's basically just, like, privileged, right? Because she's super rich, so he doesn't have to do anything. And he just lives this carefree life where he can go around, do whatever the fuck he wants, pretend to write poetry, pretend to write his book or whatever. And he mostly just spends his time getting drunk and stoned and hanging out with people. Snoop Dogg's in this movie playing a character who is, like, both his best friend and also is also fucking his wife on the side, and he doesn't know about it. Although they're like in an open relationship anyway. They're both, like, fucking people all over the place. But she dies, and most of the estate goes to their daughter, and the daughter is kind of, like, deciding, like, we got to take care of my dad. He's got to do something with his life, basically. If he doesn't get his life in order, he's not going to get any of the money from the estate, kind of thing. And you would expect this to go, like, really dark, because also Matthew McConaughey gets put in rehab after, like, going on a little minor, like, drug-induced crime spree, basically. But the interesting thing is that, like, it goes full, like, comedy instead of dark. It doesn't go, what's that fucking drug movie from the 90s with...
Requiem for a Dream?
Yeah, it doesn't go Requiem for a Dream. It goes kind of comedy, and Matthew McConaughey's character is just so doesn't give a shit about any consequences or anything. He's just like, I'm just going to roll with it and see what happens. He escapes rehab, and then he just goes on adventures with people, and it's like these vignettes of him encountering different characters, like people he knows or doesn't know, going on adventures with them. He runs into Martin Lawrence, who's like a friend of his.
Yes. Martin Lawrence, that's a name I haven't heard in a long time. That's a name I haven't heard in a fucking long time.
He plays this character called Captain Whack, and I didn't recognize him at first. And I was like, oh shit, that's Martin Lawrence. And he's running this, like, dolphin sightseeing cruise tour kind of thing. But it's like the most haphazard, dangerous version of that. And he's like, you want to go in business with me? And it's like, yeah. And this is this funny segment in the middle of the movie where they're taking people on these dolphin sightseeing tours. And these two are like,
and then the dolphins are getting sexually aggressive with the tourists.
It's not even that these two are fucked out of their minds. And Martin Lawrence mistakes sharks for dolphins and gets in the water with the fucking sharks. And I won't spoil it because it's fucking great. Jimmy Buffett's in this before he died. His music's throughout this. And like, I'm usually against that kind of thing, but it's like, it kind of works with this film, and it's, I was not over Buffetted, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I mean, it actually makes me respect Jimmy Buffett. Like, before he died, he did, like, for all the money he had from the, you know, from the Margaritaville shit, like I'm going to do a cameo in a movie by Harmony Korine. Like, that's, you know, that's badass, you know, like, you can't, like, you know, if Donald Trump decided, like, the last thing he's going to do before he dies is to do a Harmony Korine movie, I'd be like, all right, Donald, you made the world significantly worse, but, like, all right, you at least had a sense of humor about it. Like, you know.
But, yeah, this is probably his Harmony Korine's best-looking film I've ever seen that he's done. Like, it nice. Is, yeah. like, he goes all out on this, and it goes places you don't expect. Like, originally, like, as I'm going through this, I'm like, fuck Matthew McConaughey's character. He's this rich, entitled piece of shit, and his attitude is like, it seems like it's so shitty. But I'm going to spoil this. He kind of redeems himself by the end of the film, and it's like, oh, okay. Like, he's got this weird plan all along, kind of thing that he's running that no one else really sees. I'll say the only kind of point in this that kind of rings untrue is Jonah Hill in this. Who's playing Matthew McConaughey's literary agent, and he's in a different movie. He did not get the assignment. Jonah Hill decided, I'm just going to play this like caricature of somebody, and it does not fit with everyone else because everyone else is playing this like dead honest and just like running with it. And Jonah Hill's just like, I'm with the cool kids. I'm going to act cool. And it's really bad. But, this is one of my favorite films of the year. Like, I love
awesome.
It.
I am definitely going to give that a shot. Like, this sounds fascinating to me. I am down for this. So down.
And you know what I love about Harmony Korine? Like, you look at his movies, he never goes over long on any of his movies. Even if he makes a bad movie, he never goes over long on it. And this movie was in danger of, like, if this went, like, hour 40 minutes or something like that, it might become insufferable, but it's an hour and a half and it's done.
Well, he knows his content is insufferable. Like, yeah. He knows, like, yeah, nobody actually wants to sit through more than like 85 minutes of this. So, like, you know, that's the goal. It's like 85 minutes of my bullshit. That's as much as anybody could take. That's why we don't record for more than an hour 15, you know,
anyway. Yeah.
Because nobody can take, you're fine, nobody can take more of my bullshit than that, so you know. But you know,
I chalk it up more to like, I can't edit this if it's 2 hours. Yes, other than special occasions. But yeah, all right, so we're gonna take a quick break, play a podcast promo, some music, and we're gonna come back and talk about Ace in the Hole. And I just want all you people listening to know this.
Last one in bed gets no head.
That's the rule around here.
Yeah, well, you know.
You ungodly warlock.
There's this show called Movie Melt, and you probably know about it. And it's once every two... I have no idea how often this is uploaded. And it's a show where a bunch of compañeros get together and we play some fun games, trivia mainly. We talk about new releases. We have some fun games where we try and guess the title of a movie based on stuff that really probably religious people write on IMDb. Yeah, it takes about 20 hours to record. There's always a failure midway through. And then the highlight of the week of the show is reviewing a movie. Usually it's kind of a interesting, lesser-known cult-type movie, and it's quite enjoyable. It sounds good in theory, yes. I might have a listen one day.
Wow.
Wow. You ungodly warlock.
Thank you.
down at the end of a long dark street, I saw a little paper boy. Paper boy, paper boy, I've got bad news for you. Paper boy, paper boy, me and my baby are through. She was my love, my one and only. I feel so bad, I'm all so lonely. I'm looking for my love. I've got my own headlines for today. They've been the same since she went away. One dark-haired angel disappears. Seems like she's been gone a million years. Paper boy, paper boy.
Ace in a Hole from 1951, we do have a trailer.
Quiet, everybody! Listen to me! Listen!
Beneath this sinister mountain, a man is buried alive, trapped by a cave-in. And from every part of a shocked and anxious nation, the crowds stream to watch the desperate rescue crews fighting against time, battering their way through the barrier of solid rock, while far below, a daring reporter makes his way into the treacherous, crumbling tunnel that is the only lifeline between the helpless victim and the outside world.
You'll be out of here by tomorrow morning.
No, I won't. I'll never reach me by tomorrow morning.
You'll be out of here in 12 hours. Hang on!
Kirk Douglas has his greatest role as the reporter who would do anything for a story. Jan Sterling becomes a star of the first rank as the not-so-heartbroken wife of the man buried beneath the mountain.
Maybe we'll have a couple of drinks. Maybe you'll even take me out for a big evening, huh?
Why don't you wash that platinum out of your hair?
Phony, below-the-belt journalism, that's what it is.
Not below the belt, right in the gut, Mr. Boot.
Human interest.
Nothing you've ever seen before has the tremendous human interest of Ace in the Hole. For here is a startling story of human emotions and human desires played against the most exciting fight to save a man's life ever depicted on the screen.
Now, when Smollett comes, you can give him your orders. Tell him to go in through the cliff dwelling, shore it up, and get him out fast.
Not through the cliff dwelling. You can't get him out that way anymore.
All right. This is also known as The Big Carnival upon its re-release that also made it no money. Spoilers. Also known as the human.
You got to love these old trailers, by the way. I was listening to that trailer. It's like, yeah, it gives away like literally every story beat. Like, you
yes.
Know, like, you know,
yeah,
you got to love 1951, man. Like, you know, audiences would just show up knowing everything, you know, although apparently with this movie, not so much. So
no. So yeah, also known as The Big Carnival, also known as The Human Interest Story. Go figure. This is, of course, directed by Billy Wilder. We have covered him in The Apartment and The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes before in this podcast. Written by Billy Wilder.
Yeah, Lester, we need to do more Billy Wilder. I'll do everything Billy Wilder ultimately. Like, there's no
question. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Apartment's still one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, just so no, absolutely. Mine too. Yeah, absolutely, 100%.
But written by Billy Wilder, Lester Samuels, who the only other credit I saw that really stood out to me is 1950's No Way Out. Walter Newman, who wrote on The Magnificent Seven and Cat Ballou. Those kind of jumped out at me. And Victor Desney, we'll get back to him when we get to the trivia. We have Kirk Douglas here as Charles. Chuck Tatum, 95 credits. This is the first time we've talked about him on this podcast, believe it or not.
It's amazing that we got 306 episodes in before we did Kirk Douglas.
Yeah.
That says a lot about, like, you know, Kirk Douglas ultimately, you know. Like
95 credits, and here I am paring down his resume to talk about here. Out of the Past, Detective Story, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Path of Glory, The Vikings, Spartacus, Lonely Are the Brave, The Fury, Tough Guys. Then he does a lot of TV and a couple more movies before, you know, he dies at age 103 or 4 or wherever the fuck it was.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Only a few years ago. Father of Michael Douglas of, yes, you know, The Game. everything, you know, Basic Instinct, etc. Mm-hmm. Like that Michael Douglas, that's his son. And like, my God, that father-son duo is astonishing. It's just
I don't know if that's been duplicated, honestly, with a father-son actor duo.
Maybe the Barrymores, you know, but that's like a bigger like group of people, you know what I mean? You know,
and maybe the Carradines as well. We have Jan Sterling as Lorraine Minosa. She's 89 credits. Some stuff that jumped out. Johnny Bedelia, or Johnny Belinda, I mean, which looked pretty good. She has the 1956 version of 1984. She was in that.
Interesting.
And also,
does she play Julia? Does she play Julia in that? Do you know?
I don't know if she plays Julia. I didn't write down the credit, but she is in it. Someone from the it was something like someone from the other party or something like that. It was
all right.
And also, she was in High School Confidential. Looked kind of interesting. We got Robert Arthur as Herbie Cook,
the most Frank Whaley looking person that was not Frank Whaley, you know.
he's interesting because his career was, you know, kind of went into the 60s. From the 40s to the 60s, basically, where he kind of played the fresh-faced young guy who was like, you know, the sidekick or whatever. He was kind of like the Robin to every lead and like movies he was in and shit like that. Interesting about this guy, Log Cabin Republican. He was actually one of the co-founders of that kind of thing, which is if people are not in the know, basically Republicans who are like, you know what, gay people are all right.
We are gay, but we like low taxes. We are wealthy and gay, and therefore we support gay rights. Back in the time before, like, the Republican Party had any interest in anything like that, you know.
I never saw any mention of him actually officially coming out as gay, but he was never married, and he publicly dated Jane Russell, Rhonda Fleming, Jan Sterling, Jane Greer, and Ava Gardner, and Zsa Zsa Gabor. At one point. So obviously very gay.
He also supported Barry Goldwater in 64. So, like, you know, this is a right wing dipshit. Like, you know, like, yes. It's very good that you were gay and did like the absolute minimum. Like, you're also good in this movie. So I'm going to allow it, but also, like, you know, sometimes you just don't have to hand it to him. It's kind of where I land on that.
Well, I'll also say he also headed the California-based Project Rainbow organization to help aid senior citizens who were gay. So, he kind of a guy who sounds like he's like working in a system where it's like, don't say gay. But, you know, he was trying to do some good in there somewhere, kind of thing. So yeah. I won't totally damn the guy. We got Porter Hall as Jacob Q. Boot. The one thing I saw him that immediately struck out is we covered The Thin Man back in the day, and he was in that. Just a ton of other credits. Frank Cady is Al Fitterber. He was in DOA, The Asphalt Jungle, When Worlds Collide, Rear Window, The Bad Seed, The Tin Star. Got Richard Benedict as Leo Minosa, 136 credits. The only thing that jumped out, though, that I knew, and it made me just feel kind of embarrassed, like Ocean's 11. He was in that.
In the original?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did a lot of TV, and he did, you know, so like I could list his TV credits, but I don't like doing that necessarily all the time. He did some movies that I kind of know, but it's like, yeah, you know, he was in stuff. We got Ray Teal as Sheriff Gus Kretzer, 347 credits.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And he played a cop in every single one, I'm sure.
he always played side characters like bartenders, cops, other things like that. We did cover him in Posse from Hell, but he did show up in stuff like The Asphalt Jungle, The Wild One, Herrick the Wind, One-Eyed Jax, and he did 99 episodes of Bonanza as well. So a lot of this cast, when you go and look at their IMDb's, a lot of them did that thing that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood talks about, where it's like, oh, you know, you had some movies and then you just did TV for the rest of your career, basically, you know, you transition kind of
which is, you know, you're a character actor, you gotta make money. The movies are not gonna like give you, you know, the kind of exposure. TV is right there. You just go and do TV and you make a career out of it. Nothing wrong with that. Like nothing at all wrong with that. You know,
especially in like Jan Sterling's case, where it's like, okay, you're a woman over 30. We don't want to put you in movies anymore. So what are you going to do? You're going to do TV.
You're not hot enough anymore to fuck Gene Cooper.
Yeah.
Who is 67. And so therefore, you know.
Mm-hmm. So we have a synopsis here from John Oswalt on IMDb. Charles Tatum, a down-on-his-luck reporter, takes a job with a small New Mexico newspaper. The job is pretty boring until he finds a man trapped in an old Indian dwelling. He jumps at the chance to make a name for himself by taking over and prolonging the rescue effort and feeding stories to major newspapers. He creates a national media sensation and milks it for all it's worth until things go terribly wrong. Yeah, that's a good back of the box.
Yeah, sure.
For this one. So have you seen this one before, Daniel, or is this the first time?
Yeah, I'd seen this. I went through I kind of go through phases of watching a bunch of movies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I probably watched this in like 2006 or 2007 when I was just like plowing through like Netflix rentals. Right. I was doing like kind of one a day for, you know, like a year or so. Mm-hmm. It's a great way to, well, back in the day when you like just got a DVD and like I would just come home from work and like watch a movie and then like drive to the mailbox and like drop it off and then get another one the next day. It's a, you know, it's a glorious way to, you know, I miss the mail-in model. Let's just put it that way, you know, you know, streaming. Well, you know, we don't have to get into that anyway. So yeah, I'd seen this before. I knew it from Reputation. I think the reason I had, because you had messaged me and you were like, "Hey, what do you want to do?" And I had watched the H Bomber Guy video, the plagiarism video, which I don't know if you watched that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it the H Bomber Guy video refers to the Floyd Collins story of the man who is like buried in a cave for, you know, 18 days, which mm-hmm. is referenced in this movie.
Yes,
and I was like, it made me want to like revisit this movie because I just hadn't seen it in, you know, 15 years. And I was like, hey, yeah, like let's check it out. And I knew I had it, like I had easy access to it. So, yeah, this is a rewatch, but I hadn't watched it in a while. And I kind of, again, I feel like coming back to some of these things, like with fresh, like adult eyes, does like change your perspective on things. Mm-hmm. So it is nice to like revisit some of this. I mean, obviously it's Billy Wilder. It's a classic. It didn't make any money, but like, you know, it's great for what it is. I think, mm-hmm. Kirk Douglas, I love him best in like the middle, like half or the middle, like two thirds of the movie. Like there's this sort of like sixth of the movie at the beginning and the sixth at the end where he's like just very broad and he's really chewing scenery. He's really just kind of, but that's what acting was in 1951 to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. Like this is prior to the Stanislavski method, at least in terms of like film. And so you kind of can't blame him for being like, just like big, you know,
although he's the only one doing it though.
He is the only one doing it. And that's also a Billy Wilder thing. Billy Wilder was, you know, known to direct people to like tone it down and kind of do the thing. He is the big star in the movie. And I think mm-hmm. that like also has an effect. when he's in the kind of like that middle, that middle section, I think he's very, very good. When I started rewatching this movie, I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be insufferable. And then once it's kind of like after the intro, once he's kind of settled into his thing, and once we start the plot, he's much more manageable in terms of his acting.
It's when he gets mean, like when you start like really seeing his mean side, it's like, oh yeah, shit. Yeah. Yeah.
He's really good at that. And I think that there's an argument to be made that even when like he sweet talks his way into the newspaper job in Albuquerque, right? He's kind of going in there and being like, I'm going to save you $200 a week because I'm a $250 a week newspaper man and I'll work for 50. And therefore I'm saving you $200 a week if you pay me. And, you know, Boot, the publisher, the owner, he knows it's full of shit. He knows exactly what he's buying. And he's like, all right, obviously you're a skilled newspaper man. I can use you. Fine. You know, we'll do this, you know.
It's funny because Douglas does this, you know, this run around and like he'd a lot of fast talk and a lot, you know, just a lot of stories and shit. And yet all the time Boot is just like, okay, yeah, what? Come right. again. Yeah. And then Kurt Douglas is like, I'll do it for 45 a week. And Boot's like, the rate 60. I'll take it.
Right. You know, like, and I pay $60 a week. Mm-hmm. All right. Sold, mister. And it's like, no. Like, you came in, you gave him your clippings, you told him your resume. Even then he's like, you know, well, your desk is in the corner because you'll be out by Saturday probably. Yeah. Like, you know, like you still gotta prove yourself, asshole. You know, that's I mean, Boot is well, there's another character that I would also really like, but like Boot is definitely like my favorite character in the film.
He sees through him immediately. He's like, I know what this guy is, kind of, but you know, he is a good reporter for all his faults. So it's like, we could use him if he works out, and if he doesn't, I'm not going to lose anything.
He's a skilled reporter. He's going to work here. He's going to like do his job. Like, he knows what he's doing. Sure. Like, bring him into the pool. It's going to be fine. Yeah.
And, we'll give him the report on the rattlesnake thing, you know.
The rattlesnake, you know, bashing rattlesnakes in the head. But I feel like the heart of the movie is, you know, the man in whole phenomenon, like sort of like, you know, and the process by which like things just get bigger and bigger and bigger. That's clearly what Wilder is interested in. It's like it starts off as, you know, just a hole in the wall, like it just a like a little like offshoot, and then suddenly it literally becomes a carnival, and like in a way that is, it's hard to imagine. I get what it's going for. I get like that it is meant to be like outside reality, you know, in terms of like, but you wouldn't have like a literal carnival sitting there in you know 5 days or whatever. But it makes sense in terms of the logic of the movie that like it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's making more and more money. I think the film falters at its last, you know, third or so, in which, you know, suddenly it's like, oh, this guy's actually going to die. Like, this guy's going to die in this hole. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, you know, Kurt Douglas, Chuck Tatum, he grows a heart, and suddenly is like, no, we've got to actually like save this man because he can't die. And at first it's like, well, he can't die because I need the human interest story of him coming out and living. Although there are ways of writing around that. Like you can write like, you know, a story of like, he actually died in the thing and his last words were such and such, and I watched the last rites being given. Like, there's a way to write that, you know. But it becomes like, this is how we have to end the movie because we need him to get his comeuppance. And that's just a very like 1951 thing, I think. It's hard to like fault the movie for it sort of ending that way. But it is disappointing for is like as relentlessly cynical as it is for most of its runtime. And the way that it explores some of the dynamics of like the politicians get involved, the sheriff gets involved, the newspaper gets involved. Even the guy, like the other character I really, at first I was going to really admire is Sam Smollett, Frank Jacquet, who he's the guy who's like hired in to like save this guy. He's the engineer who's brought in. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh God, it's going to take forever to get this guy out. It's going to take, we're going to have to do this. We're going to have to do that. We're going to have to shore up we're going to build beams. We got a whole team of guys in. It's going to take an eternity, 16 hours, 16 whole hours. It's like, no, that's not long enough. We needed to take like a week to get him out of there. Right. Mm-hmm. And then he's convinced to like go in the other way. And then he starts embracing, you know, okay, well, we have to do it this way because I'm going to get a ton of business out of this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah. So it does show that even an honest man can be like kind of overblown by, by greed or by fame or by, you know, just financial incentive, you know, kind of whatever. Mm-hmm. Like it. And then once you're bought into it, you're like fully bought in, you know. There's a bit in the trailer that was like, you know, well, we can't go in, we can't do the side shafts anymore because we've weakened the whole like structure. So now we have to drill, you know, we have to go in from the top. We can't save this guy anymore. And I don't know. It's, I don't know. The movie is, I really enjoy the movie. It has its issues, but I think it's a very solid, like 4 out of 5 for me. And of course, Billy Wilder. I love Billy Wilder. So, you know, it's great. So,
yeah, I think I kind of sit the same spot you do on this. I don't know if I necessarily buy Kirk Douglas gets like a conscience at the end of it.
Yeah.
The thing I noticed about this, and it's kind of tipped off right at the beginning, is that Kirk Douglas is just a shameless alcoholic, and that's the reason why he lost his jobs in New York and why he's now here in Albuquerque, like at his wit's end kind of thing. And all through the movie you see him drinking, and the more he drinks, the more he spirals, the more he like he's both drinking and he's also like running with this story and like making the story more desperate and more enticing for the public to, you know, embrace. And like at any point he could like cash in on this, like he could, like even from the beginning he could have cashed in on this pretty much big time. Like, this is a great story, you know, you report it, you're gonna do well with it, you don't have to like stretch it out. But he's stretching it out for every dollar he can like wring out of this fucking thing. And like at the end, like he's got so much, like he's an alcoholic. He's obviously got like, I don't necessarily think he like feels bad about the rotten things he's done, but he does like have a self-loathing that like he takes out on the fucking dude's poor wife who's like, you know, she's not in love with her husband. She wants to get out of the situation. She's a whole other interesting character. Like, I should like spell out for the people who haven't seen this. This is like a noir, but it's also like a human interest, like socially conscious kind of story at the same time. So it's like it's an interesting mesh of those kind of genres.
I mean, it doesn't look like a noir, right?
It
like,
doesn't.
You know, if you just saw like a frame of this, you would not go like, obviously that's noir. You'd say, oh, that's a movie made in 1951. You know, mm-hmm. You don't have like the kind of classic, you know, detective gumshoe and like gangsters kind of element to it. But like in terms of its like kind of moral philosophy, it definitely fits into that noirish genre. So I would call this a noir. I would call it like influenced by noir more than anything. But well, like it definitely has like sort of the femme fatale element. You know,
yeah, Jan Sterling really is kind of like in any other movie, she's a femme fatale, right? Like she's
right, yeah.
Like honestly, well, honestly
she's morally ambiguous, and I think, you know, like morally ambiguous in a way that women just didn't get to be outside of noir, which makes it almost impossible to not judge this as a noir in terms of 1951. You know, I think she might be the most nuanced character in the film.
She's got the most interesting stuff going on, right? Like she's obviously fallen out of love with her husband. Like she's kind of regrets the decision she made. She's like, oh, I was like in the East Coast and he rushed me away with promises of, you know, we're going to do this and that in Albuquerque or whatever. And then she got there and she's like, I hate this. It's like, it's hot. It's sweaty. We're running this shitty little fucking like, was it like a fucking
it's like a gas station effectively,
you know? Yeah, it's, but it sells like
they serve, it's like a convenience store gas station sort of concept, but
it sells like tourist trinkets and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's out in the middle of nowhere. It's in the middle of fucking nowhere. It's like right in front of this, you know, ancient Indian burial ground. Sorry, I'm using that term, and you know, it speaks volumes that like one of the first words spoken in this film, you know, like literally like the first line of dialogue that's responded to by another person is Kirk Douglas seeing a Native American person and going, "How?"
Yeah,
and then the Native American person going like. Saying in like perfect English, you know, like "Nice to meet you, sir." You know, like it's just—I don't know. There is something going on there. There's something really fucked up in terms of even 1950s racial politics going on in this film.
I think Billy Wilder knew what he was doing with it because, yep. Like later on, he says, like Kirk Douglas's character says to the same character, "All right, do this for me, Geronimo," or whatever the fuck. Like,
yep. Mm-hmm.
Like. He is a racist. He's a piece of shit. Like the movie sets it up from the beginning that Kirk Douglas is a piece of shit. He is not a likable dude. But and you know, and that's interesting too, because like Kirk Douglas didn't necessarily play shitty parts before this necessarily. Like this is kind of one of the from what I can remember, one of the first roles he did where it's Kirk Douglas is playing a piece of garbage. Like he's playing a real shitty person. But yeah, fucking Jan Sterling. She doesn't want to be in this marriage anymore. She wants to get out. And Kirk Douglas, you know, at this point, it's where it becomes a noir because like he's aggressively like, "No, you're going to stay, and you're going to help me milk this story." Because I'll get you money or whatever, and also I could just rat you out. Like, oh look, right. how would this look?
There's a brilliant scene where he convinces her to stay by not telling her to stay, just saying mm-hmm. like, "Look, I'm gonna bring like so many people here. That first couple, they're the first of many. You're gonna sell so many hamburgers and hot dogs. You're gonna mm-hmm. sell all your Navajo rugs. You're going to do all this, and you're going to get out of here with a lot more than $11, which $11 is, you know, more money than $11 is now, but that's not going to get you that far on a bus out of, you know, bumfuck. No, you know. and like there's like the bus like comes in and then it leaves and she's just walking away. She doesn't get on the bus and mm-hmm. her decision is sealed at that point. And like, she comes on to Tatum. She mm-hmm. comes on to Kirk Douglas, like in very overt ways. And he has no time for that. Like, and you get the sense that like, you know, "I'll take you to New York and then I'll fuck you. But right now I have to like do all this other stuff. I am building my reputation. I am building."
Yeah. He's
and sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, he's working here. Like he has time for anything else but this, you know, obsessive fucking like direct target on, "I'm going to suck all the blood out of this story."
Yeah, I do kind of think about this in terms of like 1951. And I'm like, somebody with those instincts, somebody with those kinds of skills in 1951. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a newspaper. You could go into advertising. You can make so much money going into advertising. You know,
he could be a politician. Like
he could do so many other things mm-hmm. than being like a beat reporter, which is essentially like, and it does speak to a certain personality flaws that like he only can do this. This is the only thing he knows how to do, and he knows how to do it better than any person alive. But he has to have the victim to like suck all the blood out in terms of like making his career, when mm-hmm. it's like, dude, you could have gone into marketing, you could have gone into advertising with your newspaper skills. Like, surely, you know how to like grease those skids, you know what I mean? But like, you also kind of get the, you know, this isn't really explicitly stated in the text of the film, but you get the feeling that like even the stories that he tells about like why he got fired are probably like the nice versions of those stories.
Oh yeah.
Like there's no doubt that like, you know, maybe he was just so toxic that like nobody in New York would ever work with him again. You know?
That's the sense I got. Like his alcoholism, no matter what field he was in, was gonna like just run him out.
Yeah.
Eventually, right? He was just gonna burn out and
And to be fired for alcoholism in 1951 in the journalism industry, like mm-hmm. that's pretty aggressive alcoholism, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, again, I think Billy Wilder was, you know, he wanted to talk about that, but, you know, that's kind of a hard topic to bring up in 1951, really, for anyone to take serious, I think, because it just wasn't a thing people necessarily talked about in general public, all in the open. And I think that's one of the reasons why this film was so unpopular at its time, right? Because I feel like, you know, alcoholism, just the deep cynicism of, oh, our media is kind of crap. Our media is like sensationalist. Yeah. Hey, America's not great. We're kind of racist. Like, that's brought up in this movie as well, subtly, but it's there. And I think the audience has picked up on it. And like, what the fuck is this movie? Like, no, that's not.
I mean, Billy Wilder was like famously like a victim of the Holocaust. Like, you know, he fled Europe during the Holocaust. And so, like, he clearly has like opinions in capital O about like racism. You know what I mean? I don't know. I do think that like some of the issue is like, it's kind of, I mean, as good as this movie is, it's kind of a movie, it's hard to sell. Like, he's a newspaper man who gets in over his skis, who, you know, is like manipulating a situation, who's a bad guy, and then he gets his comeuppance at the end, et cetera, et cetera. But it's kind of hard to like sell that as like a big drama, as a big action film or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's not a lot, like, a lot happens in terms of like Kirk Douglas getting to act and, you know, doing things and having great scenes, but like, it's hard to compare this to, you know, kind of other contemporary movies, if that makes sense, you know. And you know, kind of, and so I get why audiences didn't like flock to this, you know. Like, it's hard to in 1951 walk away from this and going like, oh, this is this great scene, you gotta pay your nickel and pay and go see this. Like, you know, it's hard to justify on that level, you know.
When you look at like the reality of the guy stuck in the cave, Leo, like, you know, his situation is incredibly dire and horrible. Like, this movie is super dark when you like dig into it. Like, he's not seriously hurt, but he's stuck in the cave, right? So he's in danger of starving. He eventually gets pneumonia because he's, you know, stuck in there. But at any given moment, a mountain could fall on him. And like, the movie does a really good job of creating those caves and like having like the loose rocks, and like every once in a while a loose rock falls, but all the time constantly there's like sand creeping down through the crevices of the thing. So you always know that the cave actively is falling in. But, you know, going on the racism angle too, like, Leo is like kind of conscious of like, oh, I've been coming into these caves and stealing from this burial ground to sell pots to people. And so there's like this, Chuck is profiting.
He's literally holding a pot, like buried under the, and he's like, I could have gotten $50 for this one, which is like, you know,
a lot of money,
$2,000 or something today. Or, you know, I don't know these, but it's significantly more money, you know, but like, this is like a week's salary. I could have gotten $2,000 for this, you know. And he dies with it because, like, you know, you're in the thing. And the film takes the, you know, at least to a certain degree, it takes, you know, Chuck Tatum is kind of doing the, this is the story of, like, the you know, the mountain is cursed. Like, the spirits of the Native Americans are, like, coming and killing this guy. But the movie kind of takes seriously, like, you know, in at least one scene, like, no, this is our holy place. This is our, this is a sacred mountain. You're not supposed to go in there, you know, like, asshole. Mm-hmm. And so we refuse to go in. And, you know, you do get the sense that, like, you know, had he been like a more decent person, had he not been like a looter effectively, they might have been willing to go in and, like, you know, help him out and had like that sort of like more knowledge of like how to get in and out of these cave systems.
The deputies on the scene there at the first of the film. Well, we'll talk to these Indians over here, basically. Well, like, what? Maybe they can help. And like, they're just like stoically, like, no, we're not helping. Fuck you. Like, you know, you're in our burial ground. You're literally digging around dead bodies that we've put in this place and shit. Yeah. Like, fuck you. Like, fuck you. And what I like though is like, Leo kind of realizes, you know, too late, but he kind of realizes, I was really shitty. Like, I shouldn't have done this. I should have not done this. And, like, that's a good contrast between him and Chuck, because Chuck never kind of – I don't think Chuck ever really realizes that he's been that shitty. Like, I don't think he feels as bad about it as Leo feels with the things he's done. You know, Chuck comes in. He exploits Leo, who was exploiting, like, taking these things from this tomb. Like, there's this whole doubling down on this kind of thing. But,
well, yeah. And you get the sense that Leo is also, like, someone who, like, yeah, he's stealing these artifacts. He's stealing these, but he's also, like, kind of on the verge of poverty. Like, you get the sense that, like, this is not a going concern.
No.
As opposed to Tatum, who, you know, he walks into, like, any newspaper in the country and can be like, yeah, pay me $60 a week. Give me, like, he's bored.
Mm-hmm.
He wants better. He wants to go back to New York and be, you know, like, in the, you know, highfalutin society, but he's doing fine. Like, yeah. You know, I almost thought, like, the job interview scene, right? Where, you know, he comes in and he's like, let me talk to the publisher. And then he, like, talks his way into a job. Is like the biggest boomer energy imaginable. Although this is not a boomer. This is the greatest generation. This is pre-boomer. Like, it's even better than the boomers had it. You know what I mean? you know, this is like, yeah, look at my resume. I have clippings from other newspapers. And you're just gonna pay me because, like, that's how boomers think, like, getting a job works these days. Man, can you imagine, you know, like, being able to just talk your way into a job?
It's basically he just walks into the office, the boss looks at him and goes, I'm white, give me a job.
I'm white, I wear a suit, I talk well, you know, and I have a bunch of paper in my pocket that has my name on it. You should hire me. And, like, he's still working there a year later. Like, again, he had a perfectly fine job there. Mm-hmm. He's not, I think it would be different. I think the film would be different if he was scratching, if he was, like, desperate for, you know, money to get by. Like, this was, like, if he needed this to, like, pay his bills or something like that, you know, like, that would be a very different kind of situation. But that's not what's happening here. He's doing fine. He just wants more. He wants to get back into that high society, and this is the way he's planning to do it. And
I mean,
it works for him for a while, you know.
Like, even when he's introduced first in the first scene of the film, when he comes in, he's got no care in the world, although he's, you know, his car is being towed into town. like he's bossing the tow truck driver around, take me here, take me to this place, you wait here for me, kind of thing. He just immediately assumes he's always in charge, right? Because, like, he bullies the deputy at the fucking burial ground where the guy's stuck, and then when he eventually encounters the sheriff, he starts bullying him. He's like, listen, motherfucker, if you don't play ball with me, everyone's going to hear about what a corrupt piece of shit you are, and you're done, and you won't get reelected or whatever next cycle or whatever.
It's interesting. It's interesting because he does do that, but he also, like, he offers him, like, look, you want to get reelected, right? And the way you get reelected is I'm going to make you, like, the face of this, right?
Yeah.
You're going to be the person who, like, saved this guy. And, like, you need me, and that's the thing that allows him the exclusive access that he needs in order to, like, make his own name, right? The scene that really struck me as unrealistic is, like, bullying the deputy and like taking, it's like, no, that cop would have shot you on sight. There's no question.
Like, the cop was, like, twice his size too. It was like, the cop would have fucked him up. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that cop would have shot you instantly, especially, like, stealing his, like, flashlight out of his, like, there's no way that deputy was like fuck your shit up. That I was undersold on that particular plot point. I mean, I understand that it has to happen in order to, you know, like, make the movie move forward, but, like, you know, like, the idea that, like, a deputy in, like, rural New Mexico is going to, like, you know, not not be like a hardened killer in 1951. Like, no, sorry. This is somebody who's like, you know, this guy kills people like every week. It's fine.
Yeah.
You
know? Although on that same note, he probably,
especially wouldn't like a big city newspaper man, like even like Albuquerque would have been considered the big city. Oh, you're here from the city, not New York City. You're here from Albuquerque. Oh no, we're gonna fuck you up. Yeah. No question. Yeah.
Although on the same note, that's the kind of guy who would have just pointed his gun at the Native Americans. And it's like, you get in there and get that guy out of there.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I mean, the real story here is like is that deputy, you know, in a more realistic version of this, is like the real story is like there are a bunch of dead Native Americans who who refused to go in, and then like everybody else fled. And so suddenly there's nobody else who's like willing to, you know, even stand there, you know? And so there's like a manhunt out for somebody who can get this guy out, et cetera. And it's like, that's the real narrative here.
The real narrative is that that guy is Chris Christopherson from Lone Star.
Yeah. Who,
yeah. Like, fuck. but yeah, no, I like this a lot. I kind of agree with you that like it falls a little bit short at the end, but I don't think it mars it all that much. Like,
no, I mean, it's 1951. It's just how these things went at that time. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm viewing it through 2024 eyes and kind of viewing it as like, this could have been way more impactful if, and I think you and I disagree a little bit on the interpretation of, you know, kind of what's going on at the end. Mm-hmm. I think the film is trying to convince us that he actually has like a change of heart, you know?
Okay.
Just because I see it as there were ways of writing that he, like a news, you know, somebody who's like willing and scrupulous on that level could have written the ending either way, you know, like he wants, but he already has what he wants. He already has the cushy job in New York. He's already convinced them for that. So he doesn't need it anymore. All he has to do is just wait and like sell it as a tragedy. It's a tragedy that we didn't get there in time. It's a tragedy, et cetera, et cetera. And the only way for me that makes sense is like, he actually did feel bad that the guy was dying. And like, and that's sold earlier in the film where he's like talking to the doctor and the doctor's like, you know, oh no, he's the strongest man I've ever seen. He's healthy as a horse. And I was like, all right. So if Floyd Collins lived 18 days, this guy can live 7. And, you know, like, I don't know, like that's just how I interpret it. So,
yeah, I mean, I could sway that way. I'm kind of more on the track. Like, I was just kind of picking up on the alcoholism, and I kind of feel like that's clouding him, his judgment and everything a lot. I don't think at any point at the end of the film he's in his right mind. I don't think he even knows what he's thinking necessarily half the time.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, either way, great fucking film. And well worth seeing.
Absolutely, absolutely. Do not let me, like, you know, it is a great film. It is worth seeing. I'm criticizing it on the thing of like, it's a great film that has some flaws, not like you shouldn't watch this, you know.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's totally fair. So a little bit of trivia here. So I alluded to this before. Actor Victor Desney, who has a writing credit on this, his only writing credit, brought a lawsuit against this film while the script was being written. He claimed the film was an unauthorized version of the Floyd Collins story. And Collins was actually stuck in a cave years earlier, as we mentioned, and is also mentioned in the film. Since Disney owned the rights to the Collins story, he claimed copyright infringement. Apparently, like, he told this to somebody who like knew Wilder or something like that, and it got relayed to him is what he was like proposing here. And Desney prevailed in court, although Wilder appealed. The California Supreme Court ruled in Desney's favor, Desney versus Wilder in 1956, and Wilder's attorney settled, paying Desney $14,350, which is a lot of money back then.
Which is, you know, a few hundred grand in today's dollars, for sure.
Yeah, so he did pretty well for himself there, getting that. After the film was released, it got bad reviews and lost money. Of course, as we mentioned, the studio, without Billy Wilder's permission, changed the title to The Big Carnival and to increase box office take of the film. I don't know why The Big Carnival would increase box office. Like, what?
It's 1951, man. You know, it's a thing, you know.
Like, you should have just renamed it Dude in a Hole. You probably would have done as well, if not better. But of course, it didn't work. On top of that, Wilder's next pitcher, Stalag 17 from 53, was a hit, and he expected to share in the pitcher's profits. But Paramount accountants told him that since this pitcher lost money, the money it lost would be subtracted from the profits of Stalag 17. Wilder did Hollywood Boulevard before this, and it was like a massive hit. So that allowed
Sunset Boulevard.
Sunset Boulevard. So it allowed him to negotiate the terms for when he did this movie, and it was like, I want profit shares of this. And of course, this movie bombed, so he got nothing from it. So right. Yeah, so they fucked him on that. Although, you know, this movie critically, at least like overseas, was well received. Nominated for Academy Award for Best Story and Screenplay, and in later years, people consider it a classic now, of course. But
yeah, it's on the Criterion Collection, and you know, like you can't go too far wrong if you're in the Criterion Collection, you know. Like,
yeah, I've never seen them necessarily miss, but budget $1.8 million, box office $1.3 million. And that was, you know, that was just rentals for theaters.
They didn't measure like ticket sales in that era. They measured, mm-hmm. you know, like rentals of like the spool of film from the studios. And so that's how we have box office up until the mid 80s. Sorry, just for people who don't understand that terminology, I'm just explaining it. But
you know. And there was a 2014 re-release in China that earned it $2.3 million. So,
and $2.3 million today is not like does not make it for $1.8 million in 1951. But you know, like you gotta, like I can imagine, like certainly in terms of like its DVD and like Blu-ray sales, like this film made its money back eventually.
Oh yeah, eventually. You know? But like, you know, by that time everyone involved was dead, so it's fine.
Yeah, or at least it's like 30 years later or whatever. You know.
Yeah.
And I think that like I think there is a value to like the fact that this film is like. It's better known, like it's easier to watch like casually on Turner Classic Movies or mm-hmm. to like have the DVD or whatever than like let's go out to the theater and see this, like, you know. I think it found its place in the like the post theatrical market. Like if I was at a like you know an art theater and like this was playing, I would definitely consider seeing it, but it wouldn't be like, oh no, this has to be seen on the big screen, you know.
Yeah, I mean? No, it doesn't, like, even though there's like, you know, some pretty good looking shots.
Yeah.
And like, you know, that whole Indian burial ground, that whole like everything around that was all built for the production kind of thing, and like they actually sold tickets to it after the fact and shit like that. God,
because life imitates art.
Yes. But it's not like seeing like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly in the theater or something like that. Like you're not getting that same atmosphere. You're not getting the same perspective. Yeah, so. Like it looked as impressive me watching it tonight on YouTube as I feel like it would have been in the theaters, honestly, for the most part.
Yeah.
Yeah. As far as like releases for this, you can find it everywhere. DVD, Blu-ray. There's, like we said, Criterion Collection has this. iTunes, Google Play, Amazon Prime, Vudu. And you can rent it on YouTube as well if you're so inclined. So,
yep.
Yeah. Daniel, you have other podcasts, you have other endeavors that you've been engaging in. Please talk about them right now.
I do. I do a podcast about the most terrible people in the English speaking world. It's called I Don't Speak German. We took kind of a year off for like mm-hmm. personal reasons and health reasons, but we're back. And we do bonus episodes, as I've mentioned earlier, on the Patreon, which are usually movie episodes. Yeah. And so if you do like my co-host Jack, who has been on this podcast I think 3 or 4 times, but if you do like Jack, he is my co-host and he's on every episode of I Don't Speak German. Except for one. There's one that he wasn't on, but he's on Actually, I've missed more episodes than he has at this point, which is kind of embarrassing. but yeah, no. So check that out. And you can find that at idontspeakgerman.libsyn.com or IDSG Pod on Twitter. I'm also Daniel E. Harper on Twitter. So you can find me there.
And like we mentioned, you support Daniel or Jack on Patreon for $1. That's all you need to do. And, you know, hopefully you support both of them. But you can get the Oppenheimer review that, you know, we were trashing that movie. And if you want to hear it be trashed even in more detail, go
in to much that. More detail. In yeah. much, much more detail. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll also just mention before we get into the end of this, a couple podcast appearances I've had recently since, you know, since I've been like on hiatus from this podcast, I've showed up on a couple other shows. Did a recent movie melt where I was part of the coverage of Plankton, also known as Creatures from the Abyss from 1994, which is like a late period Italian horror film. As the bottom was falling out of the Italian film industry, but like a really interesting creature feature that is totally badly acted, totally badly dubbed, but has great special effects and has a director who is, if he had money, he'd be an auteur that people would kind of like revel in his kind of vision, but he was like saddled with an incredibly small budget.
The Italian Albert Pyun, apparently. Yes.
You know what? You're kind of fucking dead on. Yeah. You're kind of fucking dead on. Also, I made a recent appearance on the Grind Bin podcast where we covered Sunny Boy from 1989, which is a David Carradine film where he appears in drag, not necessarily playing a trans woman. It's a little bit up in the air what he's actually playing, but he's got credits on the soundtrack as well, and it's this story of this like criminal family that takes in like a baby they abducted and make him like a feral killer that they use as like their enforcer in their criminal enterprise. And it's one of the most bizarre and transgressive films I've ever watched. But
and that's saying something. That's saying a lot.
It is. It's like really out there, but it was highly enjoyable and interesting at the same time. It's also got Paul L. Smith, who played Bluto in Popeye. And also people would know him as like the sort of like caretaker in Pieces. And he's done a couple other things. He was the fake Bud Spencer in like the ripoff of the Bud Spencer, Terrence Hill films. It's a hard watch, but it's kind of fun if you stick with it. But yeah, I'll link all those in the show notes. So next time we are going to be doing The Grifters. I can't remember the year, but it's John Cusack and I can't remember the other people in it, but we're going to have a couple guests. I don't know if Daniel wants to jump on for that one.
If I can make it, I will be there for sure.
Cool, cool. But yeah, that'll be the next episode. We're going to be doing The Grifters. We'll have Wick and Chef Robbie from Grind Bin fame. You've heard them on that show, and they'll be on this show, and we're going to be talking about that. So, tmbdos.podbean.com. That's where you can find all of our stuff. And I think we're going to get out of here. You know, this is what I got to say to all the people still listening right now.
You get your spanking ass out of here.
Yeah, we don't want you here anymore. You've been listening for far too long. Go do something productive, and we're going to get out of here. So, goodbye.
Goodbye.
belt, going on underground.
You have been listening to They Must Be Destroyed on Sight. For further episodes of this podcast, please go to tmbpos.podbean.com. Thank you. Drive through.